This is Kelly Henderson, and you are listening to the Velvet's Edge podcast. This week, my guest is Dr. David Yerian, licensed clinical psychologist and certified sex therapist. I talked to Dr. Yerian about what a healthy sex life really looks like. We talked about everything from porn to losing your erection to why intercourse and orgasm are not even the most important parts of sex. Through our conversation, I realized that most children and adolescents did not grow up talking and learning about sex, so now most adults don't know how to either. Dr. Yerian is here to help us navigate through these topics and offer insight on how to keep sex fun and exciting in your relationships while removing any shame or judgment from these experiences. Here's Dr. Yerian. Okay, so we'll just dive right in. So I've spent a couple days on your website, okay, just analyzing everything. So there was a lot that I learned, though, actually, and I find this whole topic fascinating. One of the things that I read was human sexual behavior is learned behavior. It's not instinctually based as it is in most animals.
Right.
Can you tell us more about that? What does that mean, learned?
That's a big deal, actually. And yeah. Many people have the belief that sex is instinctual and we should just know how to do it. And if it doesn't go well, maybe you're just with the wrong person or something. But that overlooks the fact that sex is learned behavior, which means humans have to learn how to do sex. And that means there's a learning curve. And that is complicated by the fact that in our culture, we don't have many very good ways to learn about sex.
Right. How are people learning about sex nowadays?
Sadly, mostly through porn.
Right.
I believe. And I say sadly because porn is not a documentary. It's not an educational product. It's entertainment. And so it's kind of like, so an analogous situation would be to go watch an action movie with car chase scenes and figure out, well, that's how I need to drive.
Right.
But that's funny because we all know that's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous, exactly.
And we know it's ridiculous because we've grown up riding in cars with grown-ups, and they stay on the right-hand side of the road, and they do the speed limit, and if not, they get a ticket. And also it's talked about, and we have driver's ed. With sex, we have none of that. So most of what we need to know to be successful adults in our culture, we learn from adults in school, in church, in family, parents of friends, TV, through open discussion. But about sexuality, it's pretty much a taboo subject.
That is so true. You say also, our society does little to prepare us for adult sexual relationships, providing children few opportunities to gain balanced and accurate information about sexuality. Adolescents, through their own ingenuity, usually figure out the mechanics of sexual intercourse, but without active participation in open discussions with trusted adults, it's difficult for them to develop a healthy sexual identity. This can have a profound effect on their future relationships. So what are most people developing their sexual identity around? Or are we at all?
Well, I can remember as an adolescent, I was really trying to piece it together. It was a puzzle. It was a mysterious puzzle. And it didn't feel safe to ask anybody because it was pretty clear from tacit messages in my family that we didn't talk about these things. My dad handed me a book when I was 13 or 14 and said, read this and let me know if you have any questions.
Did you ask any questions?
Are you kidding?
No.
I had no questions.
Right.
I mean, I had a million questions, but it didn't feel possible to talk about it.
So we don't ever learn because we don't have those conversations, but our parents probably didn't learn either.
Right. Of course.
So what would you say a healthy sexual identity even is?
So I want to make a subtle distinction.
Okay.
Between healthy sex and sexual health.
Okay, tell me more.
Okay.
I don't understand.
Healthy sex implies that someone is making a judgment. This is healthy, this is not. Maybe it's this action is healthy, these actions are not healthy. Or this amount of sex is healthy, this amount is not healthy. The trouble with that is that human sexuality is an enormously varied domain. Any sexual practice you can imagine, people have done it and are probably doing it at this moment somewhere on the planet. Often religions or cultures develop somewhat restrictive ideas about what's healthy and what's not. Another thing we hear about some these days is that someone is too interested in sex, or they're not interested enough. And both of those are seen as unhealthy. And I think it's most helpful to take out this judgment aspect, because there's a lot of judgment around sexuality in our culture anyway. And in my view, it's not helpful. Instead, I want to just read you a quote from a book that talks about sexual health principles. And these are guidelines that the authors developed based on some things that David Satcher, the former Surgeon General, said and wrote some years ago, as well as some work done by the World Health Organization and the World Association of WAS, World Association of Sexuality or something like that, but international and national groups that have given a lot of thought to, well, if we were going to paint a picture of sexual health, what might that look like?
Okay.
And this is moving away from anal sex is not healthy and intercourse is healthy. And if you do more than 11 times of intercourse in a week, you know, you're an addict.
Right. I mean,
those are judgments.
Okay.
So moving away from that, transcending that. So the first sexual health principle is consent. So healthy sex is consensual. Sexual health. See, I fell into it. I said healthy sex.
Mm-hmm.
When sexual activity between adults is consensual, it contributes to sexual health. When it's not consensual, it detracts from sexual health. Non-exploitation is a principle. So sexual behavior that is induced by manipulation or trickery or bribery or guilting or shaming does not contribute to sexual health. So sexual health in the big picture is a sense of wellness about one's sexual being and what one is doing sexually. So another principle is protection from HIV, sexually transmitted infections, and unintended pregnancy. So, and these are threats that can loom over a sexual relationship or detract from the enjoyment and pleasure of that.
So that would also bring up communication, honesty.
Absolutely. Yeah. And honesty is the next principle.
Okay, well, there you go. See, I'm just ahead of you.
Yeah. So it's about transparency.
Right.
And willingness to discuss openly what's going on, like a, you know, one's disease status or infection mm-hmm. status. Another sexual health principle is shared values, meaning that there is some mutuality of connection around how the world is perceived. Mm. And that can take any kind of, I mean, all kinds of forms. And it's not just about how one feels politically, but what one values in relationship. So if kindness is a shared value, that's going to contribute to sexual health, for example.
Would that also mean like relationship goals? Like, is this, are we looking for a long-term relationship? Are those considered values?
That could be a part of it. Sure. Okay. So if one person is looking for a long-term partner and the other person is looking for a hookup,
right,
there's going to be some discrepancy there.
Right.
And each person may well feel that they're not having the most satisfactory experience.
Mm-hmm.
That would help them feel well and whole and satisfied. And the last principle is mutual pleasure.
Mm.
So I often say to my clients who come in with sexual difficulties, things like erection problems, orgasm problems, that a part of the issue is that we put so much focus on intercourse and orgasm. So we use the word sex often to mean intercourse. I had sex last night means I had intercourse last night. But I think it's better to use the term sex and sexuality to talk about the whole range of human behaviors that are about connection and pleasure. So it can be from talking to flirting to caressing to touching to holding to kissing. You know, and intercourse is just at the end of a long line of those things. And so rather than focus on intercourse and orgasm, which places a goal, so the whole point of this is for both people to get off. You know, that places a kind of performance pressure on what's happening. We got to get there somehow. And sometimes when I talk to people, it becomes clear that when they are having intercourse with their partner, that there's a kind of a straining to get to the goal. I'm like, let's get there. And I think that puts way too much pressure on the participants, and there is therefore less pleasure. So I think the touchstone of great sex is shared pleasure. Giving pleasure, receiving pleasure. And if that's the focus, all the other things are very likely to happen. Or if they don't, who cares?
Right.
Because it's wonderful.
That's so interesting to think about. Just thinking about the intercourse and the ending part of it, because I do think that that's so true in our society.
Mm-hmm.
I read about, you said our society is sex obsessed. We are bombarded with sexual images in the media. It's easy to think that one should be having great sex all of the time. On the other hand, our society is sexually repressed. Most children are not given adequate information about healthy sexuality, but they're left to figure it out on their own with guidance of locker room talk, romantic novels and movies, and pornography. So how has pornography changed things for us with a society with sex? I mean, I think this is a great point, just thinking about the actual intercourse and the ending.
Right.
But we miss the whole other parts of it.
Or we, if we refer to it at all, we call it foreplay. Like that's kind of a warm up. It's like somebody warming up the audience before the real show happens.
Right. So you're saying that's actually a part of sex.
Yeah. I'm actually saying that's the real show.
Oh.
And intercourse may happen as a part of that. But, I mean, you know, many people, when you ask them about what's the greatest sex you ever have had, enjoyed in your life, may talk about early experiences with a partner, and maybe they didn't even have intercourse, but it was so amazing to touch each other. It was so amazing to kiss in that way or to talk in that way. And I think as people have more sexual experience, they're tempted to rush past those less dramatic things, perhaps, and try to hurry towards orgasm. And I think a lot is missed with that. Something big happened around 2000, which was when broadband internet became widely available in this country, where the majority of people had access to fast internet. And with that comes easier access to porn. Mm. Any 14-year-old, any 12-year-old, within 15 seconds can be watching porn. And so it's had several consequences. One consequence is it's freaked everybody out, all the grown-ups. Oh, my God.
Right.
And it's taken the form of a moral panic, like, you know, I got an email 2 days ago, the subject line of which was, porn ruined my marriage. And that's kind of a moral panic statement. I don't think porn invaded the home and at gunpoint and, you know, somebody chose to watch it and somebody chose not to talk about it and somebody chose to think it was true and they should try to show their love that way too. And so with that as a backdrop, everybody's seen porn and a lot of people have seen a lot of it. And it's particularly troubling with young people who are trying to piece it together. What is this sex thing? You know, they're trying to learn because
right.
we want to understand the world. And it's easy to turn to porn, and it's easy to make the assumption because this looks vivid or realistic somehow that it is, in fact, real. And there are some real things one can learn from watching porn, but how does a 14-year-old sort all that out? What part is real and what part is showbiz? Probably most women don't enjoy wearing heels in bed.
Right.
And most people are not infinitely and always ready for sex, in public or anywhere, with however many people. You know, so much of porn is showbiz, it's entertainment. And so it's elements are, what's my word, amplified. They're kind of, the volume's turned up on the things that are edgy or daring or something like that. And a young person watching it has no way to judge how this might really fit. So like choking is a thing.
Right.
You know, and people are growing concerned about choking. And my office partner has a client who says that he can't enjoy sex with a woman unless he's choking her.
Is that just because that's how he's always learned how to do it?
My guess is that it comes from watching porn
mm-hmm.
and that it looks exciting there.
Right.
And there are grown-ups doing it. And so that must be the real thing. And maybe this guy tried that and got a charge from it. You know, a question is, was that consensual
right.
with his partners? And maybe or maybe not, we don't know. And I think even choking could be okay if it's consensual. If there are boundaries, if there are like a safe word, you know, if that's part of the play of sex. But again, my concern comes back to how young people make sense of this.
Well, right, because you bring up romantic novels, so there's also like the movies, you know?
Right.
And so the two things that we're learning as we grow up are either the extreme of porn
yeah.
or the extreme of a magical movie fairy tale
right.
where you don't have a job, you don't have kids, you don't
right.
have trauma from your past,
right.
you fall in love and you're making love in Italy or something, you know, which is very unrealistic
yeah.
to what sex can actually look like.
Yeah.
So where are we supposed to learn how to do it healthily?
Great question.
Huh.
I think we're doing a little better as a society. I mean, there are a lot of individuals and groups who are knowledgeable, who are trying to offer kinds of educational opportunities. But the truth is that's few and far between.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of great books out there, but not everybody reads books. There's a lot of fumbling around in the dark, frankly,
mm-hmm.
literally and figuratively. And it's possible to learn a lot that way. And finding a a partner with whom one has respect and trust, and there's kindness, and the ability or the willingness to explore talking about what they're doing together. People can teach each other. People can learn. I often use the metaphor of, what if we could learn to talk about sex the way we already know how to talk about food? You know, and food is like driving. We've heard it talked about. We've talked about it all our lives. We've been around people discussing the food, what they want to eat, how it tastes, you know, all of that. And if you're going to a special meal with your special person, you know, you go to a nice place, you talk about the food, you look at it, you taste it, you smell it, you share it, you talk about it afterwards, talk about the experience. What if we could talk about sex that way? Because it's a sensual experience as well. I really like it when you touch me this way. Or, that's nice touch. What if you move your hand a little more slowly? Or, you know, give feedback of various kinds. Or to talk about the sexual interaction the next day. You know, last night was great, and what I really liked was X. And what was it like for you? You know, which is kind of a way adults can learn to share together and learn what went well and clarify what went not so well and change and grow. Too many couples find some kind of sexual pattern that kind of works, and they stick with that forever.
Right.
Which is a recipe for boredom.
Right. Well, you're also you're talking about communicating about sex, though. Since we've never, or most of us have never done that. I know I didn't grow up in a house doing that.
Right.
So how do we learn how to talk about it? I feel like if I even tried to say half of the things you're saying to a partner, I would feel so awkward.
Okay. Well, it does feel awkward.
Yeah.
You know, doing a new thing is guaranteed to feel awkward.
To feel awkward.
And we're not going to be good at it or graceful. I think about learning to ski, for example. I was not graceful. You know, learning to walk, we fall down a lot.
Right.
So it's going to feel awkward. And the challenge is to have the courage and maybe the trust to try it.
Right.
You know, with someone who's also willing to try it as an experiment. What if we talked more about what we do together? And so we can learn by doing. There are some podcasts. The only one I can think of right now by name is done by Esther Perel, P-E-R-E-L.
Okay.
And she has, I don't know, a lot of different segments, but she's very articulate and very comfortable talking about sexuality.
Do you know the name of the podcast?
I don't. Okay. You could Google her name.
Esther Perel.
Yeah.
Okay.
E-S-T-E-R. And her books are great to read. Her first book is called Mating in Captivity, which is a great title. And she talks about the challenge of being in a settled relationship in which safety and security are very important.
Right.
And yet keeping the erotic spark alive, which often relies upon uncertainty and what's going to happen next for that charge. And she's very articulate in talking about that. And her second book is called I can't remember the title of it. It's about infidelity.
Mm.
And it's the best book about infidelity I've read. And she gives lots and lots of case examples. So she's a good storyteller. There's probably a growing number of podcasts that are just about sexuality.
Talking about this.
Yeah.
I do think it's interesting. It's, you know, you look for that safety and the ability to communicate would, for me, I would need to feel safe. And like I was in a relationship where we both had that goal, like you're saying.
Right.
But exactly like what you said, the exciting part of sex sometimes is the uncertainty, and it's the newness, and it's, you know, a new partner and on all of those things. How would you communicate in a new situation like that?
Well, it's harder when you know the person less well.
Right.
Unless there's kind of a charge of openness. You know how sometimes if you're on a plane going across the country, you might tell some things to the person sitting next to you wouldn't tell your friends.
Yes.
And the thing is, you're not going to see them again.
Right.
So it's kind of that's a kind of a safety.
Okay.
A way, and anonymity. So in a hookup, that kind of thing could occur, I think. It's tricky, though. Because on the one hand, we kind of divorce, and by we, I mean culturally, we kind of divorce sex from feeling, from emotion. And yet, the act of being sexually intimate with someone, particularly if we show up with our whole self, involves and engages us at an emotional level. We may feel vulnerable. And so how do we navigate that? And most of us want to keep some guard up. And yet, the most amazing sex is when the guard can go down, when it feels safe enough or it's somehow exciting enough that we've thrown caution to the winds in a way and allowed ourselves to really show up emotionally and physically kind of without our energy shield up.
Right. What are your thoughts on, well, I have two parts of this question. One thing that I've really noticed in society with women that bothers me is this new sense of quote unquote owning your sexuality. You know, women are trying to take their power back in that world. Mm-hmm. But to me, what I see that translated as is having a lot of partners or just feeling like you don't, and I have no judgment to any number of partners, whatever it is for that person, but instead of actually owning your sexuality and finding all of the things you just described, you know, the intimate parts of that, it seems like there's this craze for the one night stands or just overly sexualized situations. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, maybe that's a step.
What do you mean?
Maybe that's a part of a journey. Maybe that's not the destination. I mean, okay. We don't know.
Right.
And there are people who go through life and have 5,000 partners, say, one time.
Right.
Each. And I don't feel comfortable making a judgment about that. That's not how I want to be. That
right.
doesn't work for me. Maybe it works for that person. I'm hoping those exchanges were all consensual, mutually pleasurable, and so nobody loses with that. You know, I think we learn by making approximations. What I mean is we learn best by trial and error, and we learn best of all by error. Say, whoops, not going to do that
right.
again.
That didn't work out.
Right. And I think most of us learn by making successive approximations. We try stuff. We take another step. Well, this isn't going so well. What if I try talking more?
Mm-hmm.
And I try talking more and it goes better. Well, I might do more of that, you know. We usually respond to positive reinforcement. If something works well, we tend to do more of it. Mm. So I think it's possible to perhaps have a moral panic feeling about, oh my goodness, you know, everybody's having all these partners. And but I think that's a little... Well, the word hysterical comes to mind.
Yeah.
It's a little over the top. I think people are trying to find their way. And more power to everybody who's trying to find it. And I don't know how to judge and tell them how they should do it.
Right. I like that no judgment. So it's really about going back to that checklist that
yes.
you mentioned at the beginning of it.
Yeah.
to listening to yourself and answering those questions.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, because your main practice is it mostly with couples dealing with sex in the relationships?
There's a combination of couples and individuals.
Okay.
So sometimes people come with sexual, I don't like the word dysfunction, sexual disappointments of one kind or another. So there's that. But there's also, I see a lot of couples.
So what are the top things you see couples struggling with nowadays with sex in their relationships?
I think it's that many people are struggling with knowing how to even talk about it with their partners. And so that makes everything worse. Something that could be, that's a minor difficulty, so to speak, if it can't be talked about, can easily metastasize into a big difficulty. I think a common thing that happens is that people avoid sex. So there's a lot of talk these days about low desire, that or no sex marriages. I think much of that is attributable to people run into some kind of difficulty. They get their feelings hurt, or they get disappointed in some way, or something's not working well, and they feel unable to talk about it. And so they tend to pull back and to be avoidant. So if a man, for example, loses his erection one time, that's a pretty emotional thing for most men. And most men don't talk to each other about these things. I was talking to a guy last night who's a professional man who's in his 50s. He's kind of on top of his game, and he lost his erection a couple of weeks ago. And it was like, oh, my God, you know. And he's still, a couple of weeks later, struggling with his confidence or his, you know, I've always been able to rely on this, but what does this mean? Who am
right.
I? You know, it goes deep,
right.
In other words. But when people are unable to talk about things, that cuts off, well, first it isolates the person, and then it cuts off possible avenues of learning and growth. And people do turn to the internet and do lots of searching. And there's some useful stuff on the internet. There's also some not useful stuff on the internet. And again,
like what? What do you mean by that?
Well, an example is there are websites that are designed to help men stop masturbating. One of them is called nofap.com. FAP is the sound that guys sometimes make as they touch themselves.
Yeah.
FAP, FAP, FAP. So, I mean, it's kind of a ridiculous...
Right, it's not like a professional site.
Right.
Yeah.
But it comes out of the sexual addiction framework.
Mm-hmm.
It sees it as kind of a moral failing. And so we got to nip this in the bud and stop it. I don't think that's accurate information. And it's judgmental and shaming, and masturbation is also a natural act. There are sonograms of male and female infants in utero touching their genitals. And as the baby floats around the amniotic fluid, the most common place the limbs touch is the mouth, and the second most common place is the genitals.
Mm.
So the babies in utero are responding to pleasure. And this felt good to touch my mouth, it felt good to touch my genitals, and it happens more frequently. And so to build a culture of shame around the sense of pleasure one can get by touching oneself, I think just makes people feel bad about themselves. And it doesn't contribute to sexual health. So.
But again, would that be a situation in a relationship where the conversation would be open, that those things were happening, or do you know what I'm saying? Because I think it can become such a secret, and it's such a separate life from a relationship.
Right.
That couldn't that cause strain on the sex in the relationship?
Yeah. And I would say about that is that masturbation is not the problem.
Okay.
It's not communicating about
right.
it.
Right. Okay.
Nor communicating about sexual needs and wants, nor communicating about how things are going between the two partners in the
company. Right.
Or however many partners there are.
Right.
And it's easy to demonize masturbation. And, of course, it's porn's fault. Mm-hmm. And so we're back to the moral panic again. Mm-hmm. But I think it's based on, we have a cultural fear of sex. Years ago at a conference, I was speaking with a person who'd come from Australia, and she was saying, well, we're just, you know, comparing notes about sex in America, sex in Australia. And at one point she said, you know, we're lucky in Australia. We got the convicts. You guys got the Puritans. And I think that's right. And they're alive and well inside all of us.
Right.
Most of us, at least. And so I guess over the years in working with sexual issues with people, I've developed a kind of a nose for recognizing when there's shame or judgment or anti-pleasure, sex negative assumptions being made. And if we can find a way around those, things go much better. People can learn to talk with each other. I often say to folks that, you know, all the adult problem-solving skills you already have developed can work in this arena, too.
Hmm.
You know, you can figure out what you're going to do for a vacation. You can figure out your budget. You can figure out how to raise your kids. You can figure out lots of things by using your problem-solving skills. Well, guess what? That works in the sexual arena also. So I want people to feel empowered, that this is not some kind of dark art that only those who've been initiated can possibly get, but that anybody can learn just to say a bit more about what they're feeling, what they want, what they're experiencing. That doesn't mean we get it, automatically. But it's often more likely that we will get what we want if we can find a way to talk about it.
So essentially, a healthy relationship around sex in your relationship mostly involves communication, it sounds like.
Yeah, communication of all kinds. Mm-hmm. With words is really important, but also with touch, with all the nonverbal ways in which we express ourselves that we're not even aware of. And you and I may not even be aware of what we're tuning in, what the part of our brain that tunes into these things is picking up. I mean, you're looking at me as I'm speaking. I'm looking at you. So
right.
Just that says a lot, you know, that we that may go unremarked, but yet is a part of communication. So I often have couples. I take these two chairs, put them in the middle of the room, have them face each other to speak together.
Which in and of itself could feel kind of uncomfortable a lot of times.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just thinking about that in relationships I've been in. If I was facing them, it would be intimidating because I've not, you know what I'm saying? The connection, that feels very intimate to me.
It is.
Yeah.
Eye contact is intense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, but that's part of communication.
Yeah.
And I often notice when I ask couples to face each other and make eye contact for a minute, that something softens. Maybe they've been kind of blustering about this or that, and you're doing it wrong, and da, da, da. But then I have them make eye contact, and often a lot of that melts away.
Hmm.
And they can speak from a deeper level that's more vulnerable, that's more real, and that's more intimate. So, yes, communication is important. It's vital. And there's a whole range of it that we may not be paying a lot of attention to.
Yeah, the nonverbals. I never thought about that either.
Yeah.
I'm sure when you're frustrated, you do certain things, right? Is it those kind of things? Or what are the nonverbals?
So you know what it feels like when a friend or a partner comes home or you see them and they smile
mm-hmm.
when they see you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's great to see you. Or if they're stressed and they don't smile, it feels very different, you know, or can feel very different. You know, we can't really program our nonverbals. They just are. They're like, I forget how many, but dozens of pairs of tiny muscles in the face. So faces are so expressive. And we notice these things, but we don't notice that we notice oftentimes. But in an intimate relationship, those facial expressions can loom large. Like sometimes I hear somebody say, it feels like you don't like me anymore. But as they talk, it turns out the partner is really stressed or really scared mm-hmm. about something or worried about money or work, you know. But without adding the words to clarify the nonverbals, it can remain ambiguous because we don't always read them correctly. And most of us are prone to taking things personally as well.
Right.
So,
does it actually matter how many times a week you're having sex?
No.
What? Tell me more about that, because I feel like there is such a big weight in a relationship on that.
Right.
I guess it's a societal
pressure. Yeah, I think it's just a very superficial measurement that in and of itself doesn't mean a lot.
Hmm.
It depends on what you want. It depends on what both partners in the couple want. I think most couples face the challenge of one person may have a higher level of desire than the other. And it's not all men. It's about 50-50 in my experience. And how does that couple figure out how to navigate that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think affection is really important, physical affection. And when sex isn't going well between a couple, many people pull away from even being physically affectionate because they don't want to have misunderstanding, like the partner thinks they're proposing sex.
Right.
When really they're just feeling friendly.
Huh.
And so they avoid the show
Anything.
Of friendliness. And so the relationship can become starved of that exchange of affection.
Right.
So I think if sex is more than just intercourse, if it's all the ways that have some level of erotic charge that a couple interacts, it can be just making eye contact. It can be, you know, a touch of the cheek or you look great today or can I give you a hug or would you give me a hug or do you want to play together, which some couples use to refer to being sexual together. And I like that term. I think sex is the way adults play together.
Hmm. I like that.
Yeah.
I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of the pressure off. It just sounds fun.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. So I think too often sex can feel like a chore.
Right.
Or a test you can flunk.
Huh.
And both of those are awful feelings. And so, again, it can lead to avoidance.
A test you can flunk. What do you mean?
Well, I heard a story the other day in which a couple was on vacation. They've been married for 30 years and love each other very much. And So they were going to have sex, and that was clear. And then the female partner made a comment, show me how you're not like so-and-so, who was a friend, a mutual friend of theirs, who had come out recently as gay. And maybe that was a joke, but the male person just became incredibly anxious. He just became overwhelmed with anxiety. He couldn't function sexually. And he felt ashamed and guilty, and she got upset. And I mean, it was just a mess. But it was about how did we get here? How did we get to, why am I telling this story? What was the question?
I said, now I can't remember. you said something about the test.
Yeah.
How this, is it a
that
test? Would,
that felt like a test to this
guy.
And he knew he was going to flunk it.
Yeah.
I also have worked with several couples, more than several, in which the female partner, the male partner has what's called delayed ejaculation. It's kind of the opposite of premature ejaculation.
Okay.
Meaning it can take a long time to come, or he may not come. With intercourse. And I've worked with several cases in which the female partner is convinced that the male partner does not love her because he does not ejaculate. And so.
Well, we're so
test.
Programmed to think that guys will just do that all
I
the
know,
time.
Right. And programmed to think that erections never fail and they're
exactly.
like Superman. And,
yeah.
But erections are very fragile.
How all, so?
Well, so here's the physiology of an erection. The capillaries in the penis, those blood vessels are lined with a layer of smooth muscle cells. And so smooth muscle cells are different than the fibrous muscle cells we have. These are under conscious control.
What do you mean conscious control?
I can decide to flex my bicep.
Oh, right, yes.
I cannot decide to relax my smooth muscle cells.
Oh, okay.
They're not under conscious control.
Okay.
And it's the relaxation of those smooth muscle cells in the lining of those blood vessels that allows blood to flow into and engorge the penis, which makes an erection. Anxiety, criticism, worry, fear, anything can disrupt the relaxation of those smooth muscle cells. They clamp down, you know, because, oh my gosh, there's an emergency. Push the blood out of the penis, the erection goes away. So relaxation is key to a strong erection.
So that could be from anything in life, not at all related to what's happening in the moment.
Yeah, there could be a scary noise.
Right.
You know.
But what a pressure that is,
yeah.
Like mentally, if you can't control what's happening.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is it ever too late to change the way we think about sex? Like, are you ever just too old to not get it?
No. Old dogs can learn new tricks. No, and when you talk with couples who have been together a long time and they have a great sexual relationship together, it's different every time. It's new.
How is it different every time if you've been together for, let's say, 25 years even?
Because there's always more to learn. There's always more to learn.
About each other or about sex?
Yes.
Both. Yes.
So this comes from an article. It's called The Components of Optimal Sexuality, A Portrait of Great Sex.
Okay.
So Peggy Kleinplatz, who's a psychologist and sex therapist in Ottawa, Canada, wrote this article. And she interviewed a lot of people who were selected because they said they had experienced great sex and they enjoy sex. And she specifically looked for people of all ages and of all sexual orientations, and some of whom were BDSM practitioners. So a really wide range of people who were willing to talk about what they enjoyed about their sexual experience. And so she analyzed these interviews and sorted out what components came up again and again in these interviews. So here are the major components of great sex. The first one is being present, focused, and in your body. The second is connection, feeling aligned. The third is deep sexual and erotic intimacy, which really means an erotic charge and an ability to share that or communicate that or enjoy that together. The fourth one is extraordinary communication, heightened empathy. The fifth is authenticity, being genuine. The sixth is experiences of transcendence, bliss, peace, transformation, or healing. Holy cow. The seventh is exploration, interpersonal risk-taking, and fun. Mm. And the eighth is vulnerability and surrender. And she identified two minor components of great sex. The first is intense physical sensation and orgasm. And the second one is lust, desire, chemistry, or attraction. So in our cultural narrative about this, we think these minor components are it.
Right. Wow.
And they're in the picture for sure.
Yeah.
But to these people that she interviewed, and it's a pretty large number. I can't remember how many exactly. Those were of lesser importance. What was way more important was the sense of trust, the sense of safety, the sense of connection, being in the present moment, not knowing what's going to happen next, being a little risky, play, fun, those things.
Wow.
So you can make a lifetime of that.
Yeah. Wow. I think that's a good place to end. Thank you so much.
You bet.
For more about Dr. Yerian's practice, published work, and recommended reads, visit davidyerian.com. That's davidyerian.com. This is Kelly Henderson, and you've been listening to the Velvet's Edge podcast. I truly believe that every one of us has a little velvet and a little edge. So it's so important to remember that to be strong, you must be soft too. Thank you so much for sharing in those stories with me. You can follow Velvet's Edge on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, as well as velvetsedge.com. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me every Wednesday for more conversations on lifestyle, beauty, and relationships. Thanks for listening.